To air or not to air President Trump's COVID-19 press briefings? It's a tough question.
They're very long.
There is a very low incidence of death.
They're rambling.
They're the big white ships with the red cross on the sides.
They're full of misinformation.
Well, he doesn't not agree.
They are sometimes xenophobic.
Chinese virus.
They're, to some extent, dangerous.
I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I'm in for Tanzina Vega on The Takeaway for Tuesday, March 24th. Today, we debate the responsibility of news outlets in a climate of misinformation. Also on the show, how the virus poses a risk to ICE detention centers and how nurses in hospitals at near capacity are handling things.
We need facts and we need science and we need the protection.
Then we're joined by a special visitor to round out the hour.
Duarte!
Hey there, Tanzina. Let's get going. You expect news outlets to give accurate information during the health crisis. And according to a recent Pew Research Center poll, 70% of Americans think the news media is doing, quote, very or, quote, somewhat well in covering COVID-19. But one of the biggest dilemmas facing news outlets is how to cover President Trump's press briefings and how to do so while at the same time combating misinformation and reporting on the severity of the pandemic that has us all hunkering down and working from home. I myself am in my living room right now, talking to you with my kids in the next room. Now, you've heard the president's briefings played live on news outlets across the country. And if you've avoided them, let me catch you up. President Trump initially downplayed the threat of the novel coronavirus and went on to make numerous misleading, unverifiable, just plain false statements about the outbreak. Here's a quick sample.
Because of all we've done, the risk to the American people remains very low. Nobody knew there'd be a pandemic. Going to be pretty soon at only 5 people. There is a very low incidence of death.
What do you say to Americans who are watching you right now who are scared?
I say that you're a terrible reporter. Chinese virus on our nation's students. We're going to be able to make that drug available almost immediately.
Romney's in isolation?
Yes.
Gee, that's too bad.
I'd like him to go back to the State Department, or as they call it, the Deep State Department.
Does he agree with you about the need to reopen the economy soon?
Well, he doesn't not agree. It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
To be clear, we've heard from medical experts that the vaccine is not right around the corner and that the death rate is going to keep rising. The president has also been combative with the press.
What do you make of that?
Well, I just think it's a nasty question.
For now, most television and radio news outlets are choosing to air these briefings without any major interruptions, and I want to stress that those outlets are making a choice. Now, I have two guests who are going to help us better understand President Trump's press briefings and how they fit into media coverage of the coronavirus outbreak as a whole. Margaret Sullivan is a media columnist at The Washington Post. Great to have you here, Margaret.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And Adam Serwer is a staff writer for The Atlantic. Thanks for coming back on the show, Adam.
Thank you for having me.
So, Margaret, 3 times last week, President Trump said that the anti-malaria drug chloroquine might cure coronavirus. But then, a man in Arizona died on Sunday after drinking the chemical and giving some to his wife, who's still in critical condition. What does his death illustrate to you?
Well, I was just reading about that, and it was interesting that the news outlet who interviewed the wife, who's still alive, said, you know, what message would you put out there for people? And she said, don't believe what you're hearing in these press briefings and talk to your doctor. In other words, you know, go with the science, not the sort of fable or mythology here that's being put out there. It is interesting that they took a form of this drug that, as I understand it, that isn't even the kind of thing that would be prescribed for dealing with COVID-19. It was, you know, kind of a variation of it that wasn't appropriate at all, obviously. I think that the misinformation that's being put out there is potentially dangerous, and that's an illustration, a very vivid and very sad illustration of just that.
Margaret, you published a piece over the weekend that argues media outlets should stop airing President Trump's coronavirus press briefings live. Why would you do something like that during a time when everyone's desperate for information? How did you reach that conclusion?
Well, I didn't reach it lightly, because my impulse as a lifelong journalist an editor and now a writer, is that in the middle of a terrible crisis, when the president of the United States has something to say to the nation, you should, in fact, put it out there live at every opportunity. But what's happened here is that he's doing these press briefings frequently, and that they've turned into almost a substitute for the political rallies that he had been having. So they're very long, they're rambling, they're full of misinformation, they are sometimes xenophobic, you know, the Chinese virus, as he puts it, they're to some extent dangerous. And I think that I'm not suggesting that we don't report on them or that we don't use clips from them, but just to sort of blast them out there live is actually not consistent with the core purpose of good journalism, which is to seek and amplify the truth. You know, once you put the information out there, it's very difficult to sort of put the genie back in the bottle. Fact-checking afterwards is a good idea, but it doesn't accomplish the full purpose. And it's very difficult to fact-check in real time. I mean, you'd have to do some sort of a split screen and have, you know, the equivalent of CNN's Daniel Dale, who's a genius at fact-checking, you know, constantly sort of dealing with things as they come up. I just think that's unwieldy and not, it wouldn't be very successful.
Adam, do you agree that airing these briefings live is a problem, or is it how it's being broadcast?
Well, so I think the issue is that most Americans do not watch these conferences live. I think the larger issue is that they consume them through newspaper write-ups and local news clips, where the falsehoods and erratic behavior and rambling by the president are downplayed as producers and editors try to hammer Trump's statements into something that can be digested as information. So there's an impulse, even when the president is not saying something that makes sense, to make it make sense somehow, to write around it or to edit around it. So the average American watching this on the news or reading the newspaper gets a very sanitized version of what actually happens at these events, where the president spreads falsehoods about the disease and what the government is doing to deal with it. And I think in some ways that's the larger issue. You can, you know, even if you don't air these things on cable news, the way that most people consume them, they're sort of already getting an inaccurate picture because of the conventions of objective journalism in the United States, which sort of say that you have to do your best to make this make sense, even if it doesn't actually make sense.
So are you suggesting that they're normalizing it?
I mean, I think that word has been overused a little bit in the Trump era, but what I mean is not that they're normalizing it. They are trying to inform their readers by making what the president says make sense. And the final product is one in which the erratic, rambling, and false nature of the president's statements is not really accurately conveyed to the audiences and readers.
So if this is more of a structural problem, what's the most effective way to cover the president's press briefings? So you're saying we should do them live or we should not?
I think that it doesn't solve the problem either way, whether you air them live on cable news, which most people don't watch, or how you cover them later. I think the larger issue is honestly how these events are covered in local news and in newspapers, and not necessarily, you know, what, you know, 1 or 2 million people are watching on cable news every day. That said, I don't disagree with Margaret that what the president is doing in these press conferences is essentially contradicting the words of his own public health officials in an effort to revive his political fortunes.
Margaret, what's your take on Adam's perspective on this?
Well, I certainly agree with him that part of the problem, a big part of it, is the coverage of President Trump. And this has been true all along, not just with this issue. It's just that it's gotten much more dangerous now. But I also think that it's a broader, that the subject of taking his briefings live is broader than just the cable networks, because the broadcast networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, radio stations, public radio, and other news organizations, including large newspapers, websites, have also been taking them live. So it is actually a broader audience than just cable TV.
Adam, there's a tendency among some cable news pundits to praise the president when he delivers messages with a slightly more measured tone. Have you noticed this happening in recent weeks?
I mean, yes. It sort of happens every time that the president does a good job of playing President of the United States on TV. He acts sort of for maybe 5 or 10 minutes like a normal president, and then he sort of earns praise for doing the public performance of presidenting well. And I just think, you know, every single time he does it, he can only sustain it for a brief period of time, and then he reverts to form. And it's sort of, the reason that this keeps happening is that when so much of what the president is doing cannot be framed in a positive way, you know, objective journalists, and that includes cable news hosts, are sort of, they sort of feel an impulse to bend over backwards to praise the president when he does actually do something well. The problem is that it's not that he's doing something well, it's that he's doing the minimum, and for some reason that prompts a kind of praise that, in my belief, is not earned.
Does this praise take us on a slippery slope?
I don't think it puts us on a slippery slope, because the president's approval rating is already buoyed by a sort of cult of personality that has emerged around him and that is sustained by conservative media and by the Republican Party. So I think we're already there. I think what it does is it legitimizes treatment, that sort of fawning treatment of President Trump, for an audience that isn't inclined to view him that way already naturally.
If we can look at some of the conservative news outlets, you know, Fox always comes to mind. Initially, it appeared like they were downplaying concerns about the virus that had already taken such a hold. Now, have they changed their perspective on it?
You know, the coronavirus crisis has been very revealing in terms of conservative media's priorities. For an example, conservatives like Newt Gingrich have argued that it's the mainstream media's fault that conservatives didn't take the pandemic seriously initially. But the New York Times and the Washington Post didn't force Fox News to spread misinformation about the virus for weeks. They did that because Trump was downplaying the threat of the virus, and Fox News's role is not to inform the audience, not even about issues of life and death, but to make sure that that audience sees Trump as infallible at all costs. Now they went from downplaying the threat of the virus to praising Trump for his heroic efforts to stop the virus to arguing that the economy needs to be restarted again, even if it kills lots of people. And I think what I said earlier about the cult of personality that is surrounding Trump, that is sustained by conservative media and the Republican Party, it's now actively dangerous in a way that, you know, was not directly clear, I think, even a year ago.
Margaret, do you get the sense that outlets like Fox will keep reporting on the virus in the way that would be considered unbiased, or might that change?
Well, I agree with Adam about the role that Fox plays, and it's really not in general. You know, there are exceptions, but in general, Fox News is not about informing the public. It's about sustaining and building up the Trump administration and Donald Trump to an audience that wants to hear it. It's part of this whole system of keeping a sort of a mythology around President Trump. So sometimes, you know, Fox News will tend to say, well, it's our opinion people who, you know, in the primetime hours, who have their opinions, but our reporting is very straight. That actually doesn't hold up well under scrutiny. So I think that Adam's description of it, downplaying it, then treating it seriously, and now pivoting to this idea just in the past day, and this is a sort of a feedback loop between Fox and President Trump, that the economy needs to be restarted soon and that human lives may have to take a backseat to that.
The both of you have criticized pretty heavily the media, but when it comes to the major news outlets and how they're covering COVID-19, is there anything that the journalists are doing particularly a good job of?
I think so. I mean, I think that most of the major news outlets are portraying the truth to Americans, and in some ways very, very effectively. You know, we may have been in some cases a little bit slow off the mark, but I think that in general, you know, through informational graphics, through reporting, through human stories, I think that the message is getting out there from the traditional national media and local media.
Yeah, I want to say something about that, if I could. I think that the media has actually done an extraordinary job covering the coronavirus. When you're talking about foreign correspondents or science reporters or health reporters, these people have been performing an extraordinary public service for the American people. Where it becomes different is when you're talking about political reporters. And that's because the conventions of political reporting are really not up to covering this administration. And every other type of reporter, every other type of reporting desk is going to be focused mainly on telling you the facts. But political reporting in the United States is largely about narrative. They're trying to convey to you the political narrative that is occurring. And as a result of that, viewers and readers are not really going to get facts as they get them from other kinds of reporters who cover health or who cover foreign policy. They're going to get a narrative that is shaped to fit a particular storyline. And that's just an asymmetry in the traditions of American politics that has just made it very difficult to cover this administration accurately.
Margaret, you've written about how local media outlets across the country are struggling right now. Has COVID-19 and the need for good local news coverage made the decline of those outlets even more apparent?
Yes, it's made it even more apparent, and it's actually about to, or already has started to, exaggerate and exacerbate the problems that these local organizations are having, whether it's a local newspaper or a local investigative website. They're all losing their revenue because of the economic impact of the coronavirus. Now, please don't interpret that to mean that I think that we need to start the economy back up or something like that. But it's undeniable that the revenue, particularly advertising revenue, that they've relied on is going away. And we're seeing an immediate effect in alternative weekly newspapers in communities across the country that are folding. And we're going to see a lot more of it, a lot more newspapers that are already troubled, having a very difficult time sustaining their existence.
I'd like you both to chime in on this question. So what do you think are the biggest lessons that journalists should keep in mind when they are covering the coronavirus in the weeks and months ahead, but also more critically, what should average folks who are listening, reading, or watching that coverage be thinking? How should they be filtering all that coverage? Margaret?
I think that news consumers, or as I like to idealistically call them, citizens, should be consuming a wide variety of news from different organizations. They should be comparing and contrasting to try to make sure that they're getting at the truth. They should be very aware that there is false news out there that's circulating. And I think most of all, they should be listening to the scientific and medical experts whose opinions and the facts that they're presenting are available, and to actually seek those out as vigorously as possible.
Adam?
I think the important thing to do when people are reading the news is to really prioritize the advice and expertise of public health experts over the arguments of politicians regarding, public health and safety issues dealing with the coronavirus. I think we're in a very dangerous place when people are downplaying the threat of a deadly epidemic because they're concerned about making sure the president gets reelected. And that's something that I think is going to have a really terrible impact on Americans all over the country.
Margaret Sullivan is a media columnist at The Washington Post, and Adam Serwer is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And by the way, we reached out to WNYC, the station that produces this show, and it said WNYC has not been airing President Trump's press conferences in their entirety, but broadcast portions of them with context and analysis as part of our regularly scheduled news programming from NPR. The coronavirus is putting pressure on the U.S. immigration system. Advocates are calling for people detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement to be released. ICE arrests, detains, and deports people who are not authorized to be in the U.S. Now, it runs migrant jails throughout the country and is still locking people up in its facilities. But as we've reported on this show before, health care in ICE detention is often lacking, leading to deadly consequences. And while no one detained by ICE that we know of has been diagnosed with COVID-19, that's just not the case with staff members working in these centers. A number of them have tested positive, so it may only be a matter of time until migrants in these centers are also infected. Hamed Eliaziz is here with us to tell us more about the risks of coronavirus in these detention centers and how the pandemic is affecting the U.S. immigration detention and enforcement system. Hamed is a BuzzFeed News immigration reporter. Hamed, great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
In December, you obtained a whistleblower memo from the Department of Homeland Security about healthcare in Immigration and Customs Enforcement facilities. What did the memo outline, and what can you tell us about conditions at ICE facilities?
Yeah, so our memo actually found, you know, a whistleblower's claims that detainees in ICE custody were being given incorrect medication, suffering from delays in treating withdrawal symptoms, and one individual who was allowed to become so mentally unstable, he lacerated his own penis and required surgery. So these were, as far as I knew, the first time seeing publicly a whistleblower document medical conditions within ICE custody. So it was obviously a very interesting thing to see.
You're describing pretty horrific images. Are there any other examples like that that you think open a window into how the coronavirus epidemic might pose unique risks to migrants?
Well, obviously, these migrants are in close quarters. This isn't the type of situation where folks can easily socially distance themselves like we can in our homes away from each other. So naturally, inherently, there are issues. We reported earlier in March a memo that we found that was written by DHS investigators who went out to a ICE facility in New Mexico. They found that immigrants there were exposed to poor sanitation and quarantine practices during a chickenpox and mumps outbreak. These outbreaks were common across the country last year in ICE facilities. But this was an instance where we actually saw what the investigators found as far as how the staff there were treating the situation. And one thing they noted was a nurse providing medication to a quarantine section of the facility. She was wearing a pair of gloves. And from there, the nurse went to a separate section of the facility with the same pair of gloves and provided medication to the non-quarantine section of the facility.
Wait a minute. So she was wearing the same pair of gloves that she had when she was dealing with people who were potentially contagious.
Right.
And then she went to an area wearing those same gloves, which implies that she could have been a vector for contagion?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, this was something that was quite disturbing to the investigators. It was something that they noted in a memo to lead ICE officials, telling them that this is what's happening in your facility. This was actually, the investigators had been there in August of 2019, and they believed that this was an indication that this extensive outbreak, this long quarantine within this facility, several months, was perhaps due to these types of practices, and they wanted ICE to be aware of it and take action from there.
What do we know so far about people having COVID-19 who are involved in the migration detention system? Have any migrants or staff been diagnosed?
So far, no ICE detainees have tested positive for coronavirus. This is according to ICE. Our last update was on Friday. We should learn more as the days pass. Perhaps it's just a matter of time. So far, we have seen two officials worked in facilities housing ICE detainees. One was actually a medical administrative staff from ICE who tested positive for coronavirus. Another, a correctional officer for a separate facility who the county officials have said did not work in close contact with ICE detainees. So that's where we are right now. Obviously, events will change as the days go by.
Is the federal government taking any steps to curb the spread of the virus in detention facilities?
Yeah, I mean, ICE officials, they've said they take the situation very seriously. They're having their high-level experts monitoring best practices, looking at CDC guidelines on when to isolate certain detainees and to change their screening practices of who comes in and how they're screened. And they've taken some changes with visitation. Family and friends can no longer visit ICE detainees. Just recently, they've issued guidance to attorneys making legal visits to ICE detention centers and telling them that they must come with their own personal protective, equipment like masks and to try to, stop any potential spread of coronavirus within the facility. Advocates don't feel like it's enough. They want certain detainees released, especially those who are potentially most at risk of death or serious illness due to coronavirus.
Yeah, there's so much conflicting information, and the messaging can sometimes be a problem. We understand that ICE announced it would be shifting enforcement operations because of the coronavirus, but then Acting Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security Ken Cuccinelli began giving slightly different information. Will ICE raids and ICE arrests continue during this crisis?
I think we should expect ICE arrests to continue, but the ICE statement was pretty clear. You know, who has followed the issue for a little while now, it was pretty clear in them saying that they were going to delay arrests of immigrants who are not, quote unquote, public safety threats, rolling back some detention, and potentially going back to the Obama era, focusing on those who were convicted criminals and, you know, advocates and attorneys have issues with how people are classified and how these definitions work. But there is a paring back happening, according to that statement.
I mean, there's always been a lack of transparency with ICE and the Department of Homeland Security. Do you think that this transparency issues and ICE's aggressive operations could lead to more deaths?
You know, it's hard to say that definitively. I will say that, you know, we're not getting the data on how many people are being tested. We don't know across the country how many people are being quarantined and for what reason. There are only anecdotal evidence that we're getting from attorneys and advocates telling us that certain inmates in certain facilities are scared because, you know, a detainee was tested or they're being quarantined because of coronavirus. And so for us as reporters, it can sometimes be a challenge trying to figure out what's happening within these facilities. And I think, you know, it's important as much as possible for ICE to be very transparent, you know, in what's happening.
Thank you so much. Hamed Ali-Aziz is a BuzzFeed News immigration reporter. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for your time.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Geraldino. Over the coming weeks, stay with us to hear from healthcare workers across the country, the doctors, nurses, and so many people who are on the front lines of this fight against COVID-19. And today, you're going to hear from two nurses. In some parts of the USA, nurses are already struggling to get the equipment and training they need to safely care for their patients while also protecting themselves from this disease.
We're very concerned because we do not feel that we're protected with the appropriate personal protective equipment, or PPE. It's been proven that the N95 respirators, in addition to sort of a hazmat suit, is what has protected healthcare workers around the world.
Judy Sheridan Gonzalez is a registered nurse at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx. She's also the president of the New York State Nurses Association. Without the proper protection or training, Judy says the risks of infection is high for her and her colleagues.
The difference between life and death, literally, for healthcare workers is having the appropriate protection.
Judy helps us put into perspective the impact that this pandemic is having on nurses in the U.S. Jean Ross is also weighing in on the conversation. She's the president of National Nurses United, which is the largest organization of registered nurses in the U.S.
When I was working yesterday, we had inadequate equipment, but we did the best we could. We have many sick calls because people are having symptoms. We've had outbreaks. We actually have a nurse in my hospital currently on a ventilator in the ICU having contracted the virus already.
It must be so tough when you see one of your own in the hospital, in the ER. When you go home, what do you do? How do your friends, how do your family, how do your neighbors treat you knowing that you're on the very front lines?
Well, you're kind of like a leper. People, I think, are kind of afraid to be near you because you could be a carrier. You know, I just shed all my clothing as soon as I come in and put it somewhere else.
Jean, in Judy's experience, is that similar to what you're experiencing, what you've been hearing from nurses across the country?
Sadly, that is true. That's what all our nurses are telling us. We surveyed them at the very beginning of the crisis, before it was called a pandemic, which it is, of course. And people were saying, nurses were saying that they didn't have the N95 respirators on their units. As much as 65% of the nurses responding said that now it's down to 55. But we keep hearing about the stockpiles of these supplies for us, these protective equipment. And to date, no one can tell us where the stuff is. If we supposedly have these stockpiles and it will get worse later, fine. There may be a time to use last resorts. It is not now. It is not now before it has gone all out of proportion. And unfortunately, the words about how precious our nurses and health caregivers are, they're lies, because they're treating us as if we're expendable. And we are not. We do not want to see the public have to deal with a healthcare system that is devoid of healthcare workers, including nurses and doctors. And what's happened to Judy's coworker is going to keep happening and in larger volumes, and our nurses need to be prepared for it.
Are there any risks that are unique to nurses that aren't necessarily on the minds of other healthcare workers in the hospital?
Nurses have the most intimate, direct, and consistent and long-term contact with the patients because we're providing the direct care. And in some of the cases, they're not even allowing. In my hospital, they're now saying that they're not going to allow the CNAs, the nursing assistants or others, the phlebotomists, to enter the rooms, only the nurses. So now we're really super frontline, you know, constantly in consistent contact. And, you know, in any kind of an infection, it's how virulent the virus is and how susceptible the host is that is what gets you sick. So if you're constantly in a relationship, very intimate, close quarter relationship with somebody who is shedding virus, who is actively having the virus, who is transmitting the virus, you're much more susceptible, which is why you need the best protective equipment possible so that you can compassionately care for people without putting your own life at risk.
There are all kinds of healthcare workers that can help take care of a patient when you're in the hospital, but we are at the bedside. That's what we call ourselves, bedside nurses. So of all those other jobs, as Judy mentioned, that people can do, when it comes down to limiting exposure, the nurse is expected to do it. That's the way it's settled in many cases.
It's such a critical point. You mentioned being with the patients. When nurses themselves get sick, what does that mean for staffing and treatment of patients?
For example, in the emergency department, we had 14 sick calls on Saturday, and on Sunday we had 8. Because people are trying to take care of their families. And as everyone knows, there's no school and people have childcare issues. Many nurses also take care of sick relatives, parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, and they're susceptible. So everybody's trying to manage their situation. We're also told many stories about if we have symptoms or if we don't, get tested, don't get tested, stay home, come back, change the guidelines. You can come in after 7 days. No, you can come in after 3 days of no fever. But in any case, we are having a lot of people unable to get to work. Some of them are quite ill. We've had outbreaks in some of our areas. Some are just trying to understand if they're sick enough to come to work. Are they more susceptible? Should they not come? How do they protect themselves and their families? How do they come to work and take care of patients and be sure that they're not going to get sicker if they do have any kind of symptoms? So it's a terrible situation. We're all trying to help each other, but everybody is basically terrified.
Jean, we know that 85% of nurses in the U.S. are women. Might COVID-19 therefore disproportionately affect women?
Well, for whatever reason right now, it doesn't seem to be so. It seems to be affecting men more. I know they were thinking that in China it might be because so many more men smoke than women, but I don't think we really know. And as Judy just said, the hand doesn't appear to know what the foot is doing here. Nurses, you know, perform with a plan. We have a plan in mind. We know what we're going to do, but we need facts and we need science to go ahead and do it. And we need the protection. And there's another sad, very sad thing going on here. There has been a lack of hiring of nurses for some time now because our system is profit driven. So when you start in quote unquote good times without a pandemic, with not enough staff in your hospitals, look what's going to happen now. Then add to the fact that we are going to become just as sick as the patients, and we will be out in larger and larger numbers, whether it's in quarantine or actually illness from the COVID-19 virus. So that is a recipe for absolute disaster.
I would just like to echo what Jean is saying in terms of preparation. Because of the nature of the healthcare system and assorted other issues, we never were prepared for a disaster. After 9/11, I live and work in New York City, there were some efforts made to talk about disaster preparedness, but we have been telling our hospitals for the longest, stop closing beds, stop closing hospitals, start hiring nurses, start doing training, start preparations. You know, these viruses are increasing as a result of climate change and other factors. Let's get prepared. We were totally behind the eight ball, and it is absolutely unconscionable and unacceptable that the wealthiest country in the world, with the most resources, with the most of everything in the world, cannot protect its public or its caregivers faced with this pandemic. It is totally inexcusable, and we think that the government should demand and force or nationalize these industries that are making protective equipment to immediately produce what we need if there is a scarcity, procure what we need if it's available, which we do believe enough is available for the moment, and make sure that we're prepared for the future as this thing worsens, because this is absolutely criminal.
Thank you so much. Jean Ross is the president of the National Nurses United, the largest organization of registered nurses in the United States. And Judy Sheridan Gonzalez is a registered ER nurse at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx and president of the New York State Nurses Association. Thank you both for coming on the show. And again, thank you for your important work on the front line.
You're welcome.
Thank you also.
To finish out this hour, we have a very special guest. Hey there, Tanzina.
Duarte.
Tanzina Vega is the host of this show. She's on maternity leave through most of this spring. And like me, she's a new parent at home with a child in New York City, trying to figure out how to adapt in the age of COVID-19. Now, you've been asking about her, and we're delighted to get her on the line.
I've had this baby, you know, right before all of this happened with the coronavirus. And I think one of the things that I'm learning is not just how to be a mother, but also, you know, looking around at what's happening around us in the world and really saying, okay, this is a moment for both vulnerability, because if anyone's vulnerable, babies are probably the most vulnerable among us right now. But there's also the elderly, the disabled, our parents, if we're lucky enough to have our grandparents around. So it's really opened up a lot of emotions, I think, and I don't think I'm alone in that. I think a lot of Americans are feeling that way. So I just, you know, I tend to think there are also women who are about to give birth in this moment, and I'm sure that that is a terrifying thing right now. So it's a moment that's full of many, many different emotions, to be honest.
You and I are in the same boat in a lot of different ways. Whenever I leave my house, I'm always so cautious about what I'm touching, who's near me, because I'm afraid I'm going to bring that home to my children. Have you left your house yet?
I've left my house for very, very short amounts of time. I honestly did make sure that I had enough food and enough diapers and wipes and everything else. And the key question there is enough for how long, you know? I'm sure a lot of Americans are feeling like we are. We don't know how long this is going to be. And so, you know, we I'm sure a lot of us budgeted for a certain amount of time or a certain amount of food. And what I think has become normal, quotidian, everyday, you know, tasks have now taken on this level of stress. And particularly, I think, for those who are coming in contact with some of the most vulnerable, be it the elderly or, you know, babies or like you and I, or just anybody who could become infected. You know, we're wiping things down, we're washing our hands, we're making sure not to touch things. You know, I'm trying to take the stairs and not the elevator. You know, the building that I live in has also issued social distancing guidelines, like be careful about not getting in the crowded elevator or not using the laundromat when there are lots of people in it. And so you have to really, it takes a lot of mental space.
It must be good, obviously, to have this little boy to come home to, because you have that sort of reliable interaction, but so much else is sort of missing from my life, from everyone else's life. We heard from a lot of people on the show yesterday about those small daily interactions, Tanzina, that they miss. I know you've been weighing in on this on Twitter. What are the interactions that you miss most?
You know, there are lots of folks that say, you know, they're really big proponents of automating everything, including, you know, our cash registers and a lot of the daily services that we use. We're heading towards automation. And one thing I think gets lost in the broader automation conversation is the loss of those small daily interactions. And for example, there's a deli right next door to us at WNYC. And in the morning, I see the same cashier every morning. And she's there at the crack of dawn when we all get into the office. And she saw me, you know, while I was starting the show. And she saw me every day when I was pregnant. And we sort of talked about that. And we talked about, you know, days that she might have been sick or days that, you know, there was a lot of news happening. And these are very, very, you know, sort of impersonal, but also very personal interactions that I think New Yorkers and people who live in big cities in particular sort of value. And I don't think we become aware of them as much now that we don't have them. And what I mean by that is your doorman, the cashier, you know, the person that sells you coffee every day that knows exactly how you take your coffee. Even, you know, we complain a lot about writing on public transportation, but I'd be surprised if there wasn't at least a ton of New Yorkers who have all had the, you know, shared eye roll, right, with your fellow passenger when something crazy happens, or, you know, when we share a complaint about, oh my God, I can't believe the train is late again, right? Those little interactions, I think, matter, and we're realizing how much they've mattered in their absence right now.
So how are you handling it? As a journalist, are you taking this time to just think, to prepare for what's to come?
I think we all have a responsibility to think and to be aware and to prepare. I haven't had a lot of interaction with folks on the outside, if you will. But in the rare moments that I am outside, I saw someone who asked me, you know, is this serious? And I said, it's very serious. Of course, not everybody is sitting at home watching the news the way I am, perhaps, maybe too much, you know, watching all three briefings, the city briefing, the state briefing, and the national briefing, you know, from the president, the governor, and the mayor every day, and then watching the debriefing of those briefings, you know, which is good. People need to turn it off. And I think, to be honest, some journalists might need to turn it off, too, because this can be somewhat traumatic, and we have to remember that there are other things happening. There's a spirit of survival that I think needs to come through this. And what I think about today is how some people are starting to use social media as a way to come together. And, there's a new group in my neighborhood that's been created on Facebook for people to share, hey, I'm going to the store and I need help. You know, there was another on Instagram, the DJ D Nice. And he had was DJing from his apartment, and people were calling it hashtag club quarantine. And this was something that caught on with Hollywood celebrities, old school hip hop heads and actors. And, you know, everybody from, I think, Jonah Hill to Steve Harvey was on Instagram watching. And as were, you know, me and my son and his father and a bunch of other people. So, you know, this was something that all of a sudden brought so many people together to just take a break and listen to a good DJ set, you know, a good house music DJ set. It's also an economic crisis, and to be honest, it is a social crisis. And so there are going to be many, many, many long tail stories that really tie in with what the takeaway does, which is look at empathy, truth, and the wealth gap. And I think we're going to see those being exacerbated in some areas. And maybe if there's a positive way to look at this, maybe there'll be some growth and positivity towards shortening or making some of those gaps smaller.
Tanzina Vega, it's so good to have you on The Takeaway, the show that you host. It's so good chatting with you. I've seen pictures of your son. Can't wait to meet him in person.
Thank you. And I just want to say to our listeners, you know, you're not alone, and public radio is out there trying to, you know, keep bringing this to you. And I want to thank you, Duarte, and our team at The Takeaway, those who are in the studio, who continue to come into the studio every day to put this show on, those who are working from home, who just haven't missed a beat. I appreciate your dedication and your hard work during this really difficult time. And I love you all, and our listeners, I miss you. And, you know, we're going to get through this, and we will continue to be on the air as long as we can. So stay tuned, and thank you guys.
Thanks so much, Tanzina. Can't wait to see you and Gabriel again.
Bye-bye. Yay! Okay.
Tanzina Vega is on Twitter between nap times and diaper changes, just like me, so check her out. She's at Tanzina Vega, and she'll be back hosting this show later this spring. Now, that's all for us today on the show. Let's do it again tomorrow. You can reach me at Duarte Geraldino on Twitter, and remember, we're still looking for your takes on any topic. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Leave us a message and make your voice heard. I'm Duarte Geraldino, in for Tanzina. And you're with us on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway is from LegalZoom. It's important to set up your business the right way. LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys can answer questions and provide legal advice. To learn more, go to LegalZoom.com.
By Noom, a personalized weight loss program based in psychology for helping people change their habits and conquer their goals. Learn more at Noom, N-O-O-M.com.
And Indeed, with its skills test built for employers who want to see a deeper sense of the person behind the resume. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire.